Welcome to Talk Louisiana. This is Jan Swift, filling in for Jim Inkster today. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Service. Our number is 877-217-5757. I'd like to welcome Warren Perrin and Walter Imahara to the show. Warren is a successful attorney in Lafayette, and he's well known as an historian of Acadian culture. He's dedicated his life to promoting the accurate history, of the Acadian exile from Nova Scotia in 1755. But less well known until now was his participation in USL's national championship weightlifting team of the 60s, where his team banded together without a coach or funding and took it all the way to the top. Walter Imahara is a popular figure here in Baton Rouge, and he's renowned for beautifying South Louisiana for decades through his exquisite gardens. Walter is a featured weightlifter in Warren's book, and he's known as the Asian Cajun. I've been looking forward to this interview because I've heard Mr. Imahara on Jim's show, and Warren Perrin, I can't think of a better person to have on to highlight our Cajun culture, but also your success in the past. Warren, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Jan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so you're joining us from Lafayette at your home, and we have, you know, Walter's here with us. Warren, I'd like to just let you take off with this. What motivated you to write the University of Louisiana's national championship weightlifting teams? What got you to write this book? Because I know it's been a pride and joy for you.
Yes, in 2016, we held the 50th anniversary of our team winning one of the national collegiate championships. And Walter stood up during our dinner, and he gave a short history of the team that many of us were not aware of, because Walter was the beginning of the team in the mid-50s, and I came into the situation at UL in the mid-60s. And so I found it incredibly interesting what he said, and I set out to commemorate the history of that team for the university. And in doing so, I uncovered this remarkable relationship that Walter and I share personally and culturally. And I tried to delve into those two aspects of our lives and show how similar they were and how we were both motivated by the same thing through Olympic weightlifting, and that is to overcome prejudices, not only to us personally, but to our ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Right. Walter, would you like to jump
in? Yes, good morning, Warren. Warren, you very well versed on this history for weightlifting, starting back from your research showed when I won in 57, and it went to 1972, so those many years, understand you know, we won 8 national championships, which is unheard of.
And I think what it's difficult for the public to understand, without having a coach, we were self-coached. We had to decide among ourselves which of the 20 members working out together was going to represent the university at the different meets, because only 7 could participate. The rest had to stay home. And so in the entire 4 years I was on the team, I don't recall one dispute, but that self-regulation taught us so much about life, about working together, and about respecting each other.
And Walter, was your the first time you were national champion, was that the first time that SLI had won a national championship? Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I won in 57, and someone on the campus says, you know, on the high level said, you're the first national champion to win any kind of national title. Oh, I said, okay, thank you. I let it go.
So you were in a lightweight group. Like, if you can talk to people, when I was reading the book, I was interested in how you're judged when you lift. So you were like under 140 pounds.
Oh, yeah.
Really lifting weight, though.
Yeah, I was, when I started, I was like 123 pounds. And I got my body weight up to 132. But there's a weightlifting coach named Mike Stansbury just kept pushing me. But I had inside of me to want to be a champion, too.
Mm-hmm. So, Warren, you started out lifting really early also, right? I mean, you started out, your brother was an influence in your life.
Yes, my brother was a member of the team in the very early 60s, and so he had started a gym in my daddy's barn, and all the neighborhood boys would come work out. So at age 9, I knew about Walter. I wanted to be like Walter, and we all wanted to go to the Olympics. That was our burning desire. It was weightlifting was a major sport at that time. It was used as competition between America and Russia. It was sort of like a proxy of the Cold War, where America had dominated the sport in the 30s and 40s, and Russia wanted to show that their system was better than us, and they could do this by beating us in the Olympics. And so the story of our team is a bigger story. It's a story about how we were part of the world stage, and neither Walter nor I were able to go to the Olympics. But one of our friends, David Berger, who was lifting for Tulane, he did make it to the Olympics representing Israel because he was Jewish. And unfortunately, he was murdered by Black September in the Munich Olympics of 1972. So it's a sad irony. And Walter and his wife actually went to the Olympics to watch David Berger lift, and he was killed 2 days later.
That's a tragedy. Oh, I remember those times, though. So, Warren, when I was reading the book, I didn't realize, I know you're saying weightlifting was popular, but it wasn't for athletes, right? Like, this was something that was an emerging tool to get athletes stronger. I didn't realize that before maybe the 50s, athletes didn't work out with weights.
Louisiana was really the hotbed, and it was the springboard that led to today. Every athlete uses weights in some form. Mm-hmm. They believed it made you muscle-bound. What really helped was Alvin Roy starting a little TV show, and he started working out with guys like Billy Cannon, who was one of Walter's classmates at Estruma, and then they won the 58 National Football Championships. And it made other people realize weight training will help you in all facets of athletic achievement. It made you quicker and stronger. And so it really became super popular in the early 60s until powerlifting, which is a similar sport, but a little different because it has different movements. And today, powerlifting is what is really popular rather than Olympic weightlifting.
Right. Are you still weightlifting, Warren?
Every day I do it in my garage. I don't go to Red Laurel's gym because of the pandemic, but I do lift the bar every day.
Yeah. When I was talking with Walter before we started the show, I know he lifted weights for over 50 years as a master weightlifter. And if you want to talk about that, I mean, you did this your whole life. You've kept up.
Yeah, it's a whole life. When you consider, I started in with Mike Stansbury at SLI Lafayette, 1955. That was my first meet. And my last meet was 2005 as a master's at a national championship in Baton Rouge. And I invited Mike Stansbury and then Red Laurel. So they were at my last championship.
Yeah. So for our Lafayette listeners, yeah. Red Laurel is just renowned. Yeah. But I didn't realize Mike Stansbury was where he got his start.
Yeah, that's where he began.
Yeah, yeah. So, Warren, did you work out with him? Like, were you still – I know you were a little bit younger than Mr. Imahara and some of the first crew, but did you work out in Lafayette, or would you stay, like, you know, at your home when you were working out? Because I know you had a big setup.
Yeah, well, I competed throughout high school, and my brother would bring me to the college meets, and so I had a lot of experience by the time I entered USL in 1965, and I was invited to participate in the first team that I went to the Nationals in 1966, where we won at the University of Maryland, and then we won 2 years after that. We were undefeated for five straight years, and I find one of the most interesting stories is we had so much depth. We got invited to two meets on the same day, one in Texas and one in New Orleans. And we split the team into two teams, and we went to both meets, and we finished first in both meets. So that demonstrates the depth that we had. And two of our lifters went on to become strength coaches for NFL football teams. Joe Murray was the strength coach for the Buffalo Bills when O.J. Simpson broke the rushing record, and Lou Ricci was the strength coach for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he developed what was called the Steel Curtain, where the defensive line They won exceptionally strong.
Warren, we'll be back. We need to take a break. We'll be back in about 90 seconds. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. This is Jan Swift, sitting in for Jim Inkster. Our number is 877-217-5757 if you'd like to call in. We're here with guests Warren Perrin and Walter Imahara, who are discussing the colorful history of their friendship and their championship UL weightlifting teams. So, Warren, I had tabbed the book on page 58. One of my favorite chapters was an amazing Asian, and it's where you really lay out your friendship with Walter and his background, coming, you know, as a Japanese American, what had happened during World War II, and the similarities with what had happened to the Acadians. If you can jump into that, I think this is probably one of the most telling chapters in the book about your love for Walter and the sport.
Yes, Walter's ancestor was a samurai fighter in Japan, and his family immigrated to America in the 19th century. And my family was led by Beausoleil Broussard. After the Acadian deportation, they came to Louisiana in the 18th century. So although the ancestors came a century apart, the story is very similar, both victims of ethnic cleansing. And the story of Walter's family being deported and from their home in California to a relocation camp in Arkansas led me to launch my effort to obtain an apology for the Acadian deportation against the British Crown and Queen Elizabeth II, because America apologized to Walter's people, the Asians, in 1988, and that made me realize it was an epiphany that the similarity between the two had to be addressed. I researched it for 2 years, and then I prepared a lawsuit, launching a petition, ultimately obtaining the Queen's apology in 2003.
Right.
Entirely inspired by Walter.
That proclamation was something, huh? I mean, England apologized for what was done all those years ago.
In the 1,000-year history of the British Empire, this is the sixth apology that was extended to a group of people.
And so you met the Queen?
No.
No?
The Queen's representative signed the document in Canada. The Queen doesn't sign anything. She represented herself through the Governor General of Canada, Adrian Clarkson. The document is officially a document of the Canadian archives, but at the Acadian Museum of Erath, we have the only signed copy on display.
Mm-hmm. And Warren, I do want to say again, you have really spent your life documenting the history of the Acadians, and you have fought tirelessly to get rid of a disparaging word that people used to use to describe the Acadians. If you want to touch on that, what you've done, the museum in Erath, if you can touch on that.
It really, it's important to understand, we were not exiled. We were not asked to leave. We were not given a deadline to leave. We were deported. When you're deported, you don't get a chance to pack your toothbrush. We were captured, imprisoned, and forced onto ships. So it was the first act of ethnic cleansing, some now call it genocide, in North America. And it set the stage for the later ethnic cleansing of the Native Americans and other peoples. And both Asians and Cajuns are both protected today under the Civil Rights Act because of past invidious discrimination. And it's interesting that Walter's grandparents couldn't speak English, neither could my parents or grandparents speak English. And we both overcame that type of cultural disparity through weightlifting. You couldn't beat us on the platform. You could maybe call us a dirty Jap or a damn coon ass, but on the stage, we were victorious. And that helped us overcome that sort of cultural baggage.
Right. So, Walter, your family was deported in many ways also. If you want to touch on that, what happened during World War II?
Okay, I'd like to remind the listeners that tomorrow is December 7th, 1941. That means 80 years ago, I was, 4 years old, and we heard about what happened at Pearl Harbor, and I changed our lives forever. Okay, at that time we were living in California, and my parents had all those children, and we had to leave everything behind because we were all being put into, we call it still concentration camp, relocation camp, where we spent 3.5 years. And during this period, my parents always spoke about, we are Americans, we are Americans. So that was denied. And I could ask, and I remember that Warren asked me many times about the apology that we received, okay? And I said, Warren, in 1990, we finally got the letter of apology and a check for $20,000, but it took 45 years. But then Warren was listening, and when he's working with the Acadians, I mean, we're talking about 300-400 years, so it's a lot of difference. But he found a lot of similarity that all we wanted was an apology. We weren't asking for anything else. So it made a lot of difference in and the 122,000 Japanese Americans that were put into relocation camp, 3.5 years, 10 different camps, and we ended up in Arkansas.
But Walter, you found Lafayette, Louisiana, to be a welcoming place as a Japanese American. I know Warren touches on that in the book, that it was really a good place for you to feel welcomed.
Well, you got to remember, when I started college in 1955, I went to LSU for a while, and got to remember, everything was a white school then. So I was still an outsider, and my parents said, won't you go to Southwestern, SLI, because the Acadian people down there, and sure, it made a difference when I went there. How can they be prejudiced against me when their background was the same prejudice against them? So they kind of understood, and then I became an Asian Cajun.
Right. You're saying that Joel Fletcher, the head of the university at the time, dubbed you the Asian Cajun.
Yeah, and that was 1960, though. That's a long time graduated ago, see. Mm-hmm. But Warren has he knows about the history about the Imahara family.
Yeah. So, Warren, I read in the book you were talking about, and I mean, Walter can touch on it, but how he was treated and disparaged when you won your national championship. I think it was your third national weightlifting championship, and yet the headline was such that it was totally disrespectful to you, Walter. If you want to...
I had to pull that out of Walter. He didn't want to discuss it. It was such a difficult part of his life where he wins his third national championship, and the headline called him a Jap boy, and he threw the article away. And he didn't at first want me to mention it in the book, but I just told him I thought it was too important not to mention, and I appreciate him allowing us to share that because he went to the top. He won the Pan American Games. He would have represented America at the Olympics had he not been injured. And he's always been just a model for us to look up to. And I just thought it was important to know there were some low points. But he was also threatened in California, where he went to a national YMCA meet. Some of the lifters were making disparaging remarks. And he simply did like the great Tommy Kono, who was also Asian American and Olympic champion, said, you ignore their remarks, you beat them on the platform, which is exactly what Walter did.
We have about a minute left, and I see we have Phil from Jefferson Terrace on line two. Phil, welcome to Talk Louisiana.
Yes, welcome. I don't know, this is a good time to be talking about this. The Jewish diaspora was run out of cities and countries. Do you know where the term fired originated? You're fired because the village decided that they would burn down your house because they wanted you to leave the village so badly. That's where the term being fired came from.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah. Well, I want to thank both Walter Imahara and Warren Perrin. Again, the book we've been talking about is The University of Louisiana's National Championship Weightlifting Teams, and there's also a companion book to the documentary, The Raging Cajun. Warren, is that available for people? Where can people see that documentary?
The name is Raging 13 years, we won 8. It's going to be first shopped around to different film festivals before we...
Thank you, Warren. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. This is Jan Swift, filling in for Jim Easter. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Service. Our number is 877-217-5757. We're honored to have Jeremy Alford joining us in the studio today. Jeremy is publisher and editor of Law Politics Weekly, the state's leading trade publication for elected officials, campaign professionals, and donors. He's also the author of The Last Constitution and co-author of Long Shot, which looks back at Louisiana's 2015 race for governor. And Jeremy's also a regular contributor to the New York Times and an on-camera analyst for CNN, Fox, and MSNBC and C-SPAN. And of course, we read your article in the paper and online. So Jeremy Alford, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be back. It's good to see you.
Yeah, you too. We met in Lafayette years back. I don't even know if you remember that.
But yeah.
You kind of made the big time now. And I've enjoyed watching your career, following in the footsteps of John McGinnis and others before you.
That's right. I think about John often. You know, at the end of the year, when McGinnis would be interviewed by TV stations and reporters that asked him how it went, he would talk about the legislature. He would always say that, you know, they could have done less, but they ran out of time. And I always thought that was a classic line, but I'm not sure that applies to this calendar year. It's been a pretty busy political year.
Yeah, so I thought at the end of the year it'd be good just for you to maybe talk about what you think the biggest news was in politics and where we are at the end of this year. I know there's a lot brewing with the redistricting, so there's plenty to talk about.
You know, it's interesting because this is the time of year that reporters and editors tend to kind of go and look back at the stories that have been resolved that defined the previous months. But we have so much that's unresolved heading into 2022 that I think the big story is these developing storylines. We have a record amount of infrastructure money mm-hmm. headed to the state that officials are trying to figure that out. We have redistricting that's just around the corner. The commissioner of administration is trying to put enough money together to help finish the renovations at the Superdome. And there's a real interesting political battle there where where rural lawmakers are getting a little sick and tired of sending money to New Orleans and not enough coming to them, and that's starting to show in that debate. But there's just plenty kind of still going this year.
Right. Well, let's talk about the infrastructure. Are we ever going to get that bridge, you know, the new Mississippi River Bridge, or will any of that money go towards things that will actually help traffic?
I think that's going to be the big task of our policymakers in the state is where will this record-setting influx of federal money go, and how will it be spent, and how will projects be prioritized? The legislature just recently passed a change in the way transportation money is routed in the state and how it can be spent. So we were already seeing a boom on the horizon in construction spending and for infrastructure. So this is going to only add to that. And, you know, that's going to be one of the big questions moving forward is what happens there. And every region has that bridge. Every region has a big project.
About
that
Lake Charles, you know, everybody's got something.
Right. And the trick is, as always, is going to be mm-hmm. kind of who's at the front of the line.
So when you talk about infrastructure, that also means improving the drinking water. I mean, it's not just hard, like it's
that's
pipes
right.
and all, but I mean, this is critical that we have some communities that don't have safe drinking water.
And that, you know, actually the first big investment from that federal money is already headed to Louisiana, and it's going to be used for drinking water systems. And that's a big conversation at the Capitol right now. There are a number of projects around the state all jockeying for funding, and there's another federal pot of money that's at play that the governor is going to be releasing some projects for potential funding next month. So that's all coming to a head right now.
How much money are we getting?
Oh, I off the top of my head,
billions,
I don't know.
You know?
Yeah, it is a significant amount of cash.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also for the Superdome, none of that money can go to things like that, right? It's the federal money, or is that something that I know they're looking for, what, $450 million
you know,
to renovate the Superdome?
In my experience, if money can be used for a different purpose or rerouted, the legislature and an administration in Louisiana will find that route. And actually, that's one of the, you know, the question of whether the Superdome will the renovations there will be able to be finished, if the state will send the money over there. You know, the administration and the legislature tried to come to an agreement on about $20, $21, $22 million to do that. When those talks broke down, the one of the recommendations from the administration is to use some money that was the result of COVID-19 relief funding.
Oh.
So you know, we often see money kind of moved around on the state level. It's not uncommon to see that happen.
How long have you been a political commentator?
Well, you know, I've been a freelance journalist covering nothing but Louisiana politics for 20 years. I started working with John McGinnis about 10 years ago. So I've been doing it for two decades. I came in at an interesting time because one of the first things I covered was the redistricting session
right.
two cycles ago.
Yeah.
So this will be my third coming up here.
That was going to be my question. In the time that you've been working at the Capitol, as an example, it just seems like the more we redistrict and draw those lines where it's all Republican or all Democrat, things have changed where it's so partisan. I lobbied back in the 80s and early 90s, and while you had politics, of course, it wasn't the divisive type of politics that you see now. And it seems like every 10 years we're digging a deeper and deeper hole to have people against each other instead of working together, no matter what party.
I mean, it's much more partisan, but redistricting is a whole different thing. And for anyone who doesn't know, redistricting happens every 10 years, and based on the U.S. Census figures, our state legislators redraw the election lines for the legislature, Congress, BSEE, the PSC, judicial lines. And it's a very personal and it's a very political process. And I'll give you two anecdotes from the sessions I've covered. The first redistricting session I covered, I remember waiting outside of a committee room, and they were starting much later than expected. It dragged on for hours. And when I finally got inside, I figured out that there was a lawmaker in LaFouche who was trying to draw a political opponent out of his district
right.
so he wouldn't run against him next year. You know, fast forward to 10 years later, the last redistricting cycle, and we were scheduled to lose a congressional district, which happened. And I actually saw members of Congress not only show up in Baton Rouge, but lobby state legislators.
Wow.
And those were both moments where I was like, okay, this is what's going
right.
on. And you know, this upcoming redistricting session is going to be no different. And I would argue that it's probably going to be a little bit more intense, because something else I noticed about those two sessions is if you attended the redistricting sessions and you looked around, not a lobbyist to be found. Because I think most professional lobbyists, especially contract lobbyists, know that if anything goes wrong on an election district or lines get kind of funky and they are even perceived to be involved in that, that's going to make their life very difficult
right.
over the next 10 years. But, you know, this go around, we have all these special interests that are going to be involved. We're going to have more outside groups involved in redistricting in February than we've ever seen in Louisiana.
Because at the national level.
That's right.
They want to make sure they keep their Republican seats and Democratic seats.
That's right. And the governor has a role to play in this. Mm-hmm. And that was a big part of John Bel Edwards' reelection, was that he would be in the governor's chair with that veto authority. What the governor is going to do, we don't know quite yet. He's been quiet, but you know, he has some options available to him, and he has a stick. He has some leverage in this.
Do you know, like, if he vetoed, is it one bill or is it many?
So
bills?
If what has happened in previous redistricting sessions is any indication, we'll see a bill for Congress. We'll see a bill for BSEE. We'll see a bill for PSC. The governor vetoes them. Lawmakers would just have to go back and try to keep doing it. Hopefully they'll get him some options early in the session to where they still have time to come back and redraw some things. But, you know, I'm interested to see what the governor's going to do on these legislative districts, because a lot of these fights are Republican versus Republican, and I don't think the governor either wants to wade into that or give Republicans any kind of a win. The judicial lines, however, I think are going to be interesting. The governor can issue vetoes on judicial lines in a different manner than he can with these other maps. And, you know, lawmakers are looking at redistricting the Supreme Court for the first time in a very long time.
Republican versus Republican. Is that what you're talking about, trying to keep out opponents?
Or yeah, and look, when you just slowly start to take over the legislature and you add to those Republican numbers each and every year without exception, at some point you have no one left to fight but yourself. And that's what we're seeing with Republicans is that there's so many in there. And it's no longer, for conservative backers of legislative candidates, it's no longer good enough just to be a Republican. It's what kind of Republican are you?
I'm trying to figure out what kind I am, because I feel like I'm more Ronald Reagan, kind of, you know what I'm saying, like middle of the road,
mm-hmm.
not wanting to get in people's lives. And
I think a lot of Republicans in the legislature are probably thinking the same thing after these last couple of sessions.
Might be time to go home.
That's right.
What do you think about the governor where he is now? Like, what are you forecasting he might accomplish?
So the governor is halfway through with his final term now. He has about 2 years left. You know, it's interesting. He campaigned on behalf of a state Senate candidate earlier in the fall. And the speech that the governor gave at the rally really gave an overview of kind of what his focus is going to be moving forward. You know, the governor has always advocated for a higher minimum wage, equal pay, and I think he'll be at the table on those again. But I think we're going to see a big push from the governor on insurance matters. That's a policy topic that's only going to trend harder and harder as we get closer to session. Climate change is going to continue to be a top issue. I mean, Louisiana's governor is literally an international voice on this policy topic. I don't think anybody would have ever thought that just a couple of years ago.
About the coast,
the sea level rising, and the governor has already taken some actions by executive order, and we'll have to see whether he's going to pursue anything legislatively or we'll see more by executive order, but I think he'll continue to do that. He's also going to continue to push to get teacher pay to the Southern Regional Average. That is something he has said a couple times this year, so I think that's going to be on top of his agenda for the upcoming session.
You know, that's critical. I've just read with interest they can't get enough education students. I mean, it's hard to get people to want to go into education these days, so we're going to have to step up if we're going to get that to
happen. I mean, that's certainly the big sticking carrot is compensation.
Right. We just have a few, like a half a minute left. What would you, was there something you wanted to get in today, any topic you wanted to talk about, or where can people read your thoughts? Like, where can we go to find Jeremy Alford's work?
You can go to lapoliticsweekly.com. That's lapoliticsweekly.com.
Yeah. It's really good, and you always have that kind of humorous touch when you write. So I want to tell you it's been a pleasure to get to know you, and thank you for joining us.
It's Louisiana politics, better to laugh than cry.
I think so. And I'd like to get you, please, stay with us. We're going to come back, and we're going to be talking about the Atlas of a Changing Climate with Brian Buma, who's traveled the globe. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. This is Jan Swift. I'm filling in for Jim Engster. Our number is 877-217-5757. We're joined by Brian Buma, professor at the University of Colorado in Denver. He's a prolific writer and researcher, and he is a disturbance ecologist. He's traveled the globe to track ecological change and climates. We're here to discuss his new book, The Atlas of a Changing Climate, that examines the forces driving Earth's changes. And it's got a beautiful, over 100 beautiful contemporary and vintage maps. I'd like to welcome Brian Buma to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Hello?
Brian?
Yeah, hi, I'm here. Can you hear me?
No? Hold on 1 second, we're having a technical difficulty. I don't have sound on my my end.
Okay.
I apologize. Brian,
no problem.
There you are. Okay, now I have sound. Yeah. The sound went out. Brian, I am a podcaster in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I have to tell you, doing live radio is so different. It's always a challenge. And anyway, welcome to our show. I love your book. It's absolutely
gorgeous.
Oh, I'm
glad you like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, I've got it in front of me, and the first thing that I wanted to get you to bring up is, I guess tell us first, what is a disturbance ecologist?
Sure. Think natural disasters. So my field goes into ecosystems after fires or before fires, after hurricanes, which are more common down there, after floods, sort of someone who follows those sorts of big, fast changes and tries to see how the ecosystem responds or recovers or acts or whatever the question is. Yeah.
Right. And as you start the book out, one of the most compelling photos is the famous blue marble photo that Apollo 17 took. And I'd like you to talk on that, please, if you would, because you're saying that was really when people came to realize that everything is a piece of the whole. Like, we all make a difference. And there's nowhere else to go. Like, we are on Earth together, and as a team, we're affecting the Earth, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, a big theme of the book is how connected everything is and how the systems of the Earth work at the scale of the Earth. And what I mean by that is why it is not sufficient just to look at the weather around you and say, this is representative of the globe. And until people really started seeing the world at once, you know, looking bigger than just their neighborhood. That was a really hard thing to imagine. Prior to the 1800s, we didn't even really have big scientific maps of the world. We had maps, but we didn't have scientific maps of the world. And it was very hard to imagine how the natural systems, you know, how the atmosphere worked or how the ocean worked, because we weren't seeing it at the right scale. And then when the blue marble came out, when we had astronauts looking back at the world, that became real for everybody, not just the scientists. It was like, this is the whole thing. You can see in that particular picture, you can see hurricanes moving across the Indian Ocean, or typhoons, you know, large atmospheric systems. You can see how areas that are 1,000 miles away are still connected to each other. Mm-hmm. And so it really made it visceral. And I think the power of imagery is unparalleled in that respect.
You know, for us here in Louisiana, climate is a big deal. And it seems like, as you know, we're getting hit more and more frequently with really devastating hurricanes. If you could maybe touch on some of that for our listeners. I mean, this is probably one of our biggest issues with the coastal erosion and the havoc wreaked by hurricanes here.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, Louisiana is really interesting, actually. It's one of the few spots in the United States where it hasn't actually warmed that much in terms of actual temperature, which is kind of interesting, but it should be a warning to people in Louisiana. Everywhere else is dealing with hotter temperatures, and you guys will soon as well. But to the point of erosion, yeah, Louisiana is losing about 25 square miles of land per year in recent decades, and a lot of that's due to hurricanes. And floods. It's difficult for us to predict how hurricanes are going to go because we don't have the best long-term record, but it seems likely they'll intensify. And certainly you're getting heavier storms. So the amount of precipitation falling during heavy rainstorms in the southeast has increased by about a quarter, about 27%. So you're getting a trend towards more and more rain when it rains, which obviously leads to more erosion and more flooding.
Yeah. And then we have more concrete, too, with all the development.
Yeah.
And so, with, you know, we don't have the green space that absorbs all the water. It's become a problem even just with rainstorms. People's homes flood over and over, you know, and it's...
For sure. And you're connected to folks in the upper Midwest, you know, as dams on the Mississippi come or go, or levees on the Mississippi come and go, or as climate warms up in the upper Midwest, causing more and faster snow melt in the spring. I mean, all this stuff is tightly connected. It just seems like a long ways away. But as you said, with the blue marble, it's not really.
Right. Now, you've traveled the whole globe, right? If you want to talk about that, you've really traveled and seen all the different types of climates that we have.
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to have a position where the work takes me to all sorts of interesting places. And the one thing it, you know, does emphasize is that everybody is kind of in the same, or is in the same boat. You know, I used to live in Alaska, and most of my work still is in Alaska. And up there, you know, no one argues with climate change. It's 100% apparent. You know, the ground is thawing, the winters are becoming shorter. But it's the same thing in the Southern Hemisphere, too. And it's the same thing over in Northern Europe. It's everyone is feeling these things, and they may think it's local, or they may think, oh, it's just Louisiana getting more hurricane, you know, more intense storms, but it's not. We're all facing various aspects of the same fundamental phenomenon, which is the point of the book, which is trying to take the mystery out of that change and say, look, these things are all connected. There is a reason why sometimes these climate change effects can result in cold snaps. I mean, there's a reason for that. It's not that the world's getting colder, it's that cold air is moving around. And I think when folks see that, when they see it at the proper scale, they see it at the scale of the globe, it becomes self-obvious. And I hope it takes the mystery out of the science for folks.
And with the increased warming, I mean, Alaska as an example, you know, has that changed a lot? The temperatures
there,
if you can touch on that. I was interested in that.
Yeah, the high latitudes of the world, especially the Northern Hemisphere, the higher the latitudes, the closer you go to the North Pole, the faster the climate is warming, like three times faster than down here. And it's 100% apparent. If you go to northern Alaska, what you see is permafrost thawing. So the ground is frozen year-round once you go down a couple of feet. And that frozen layer is getting deeper and deeper, and that's causing all sorts of infrastructure problems. Roads are falling apart. Houses are starting to sink. Cellars are flooding. But you also see it in shorter winters. You see it in glacial retreat. And that glacial retreat in Alaska, where I lived in southeast Alaska, is heavily glaciated. Those glaciers are retreating very quickly. Mike, you can see it year to year. That's going into the ocean. And so that is contributing to your problems in Louisiana. A good fraction, about half of our sea level rise that we're currently dealing with is coming from melting ice on land. So it may seem like a long ways away, Alaska, but that water is going right to your front doorstep.
Right. And so the wildlife habitats are shrinking. I mean, all this is affecting so much more beyond humans. It impacts everything.
Certainly. Yeah, certainly. Some wildlife habitat is shrinking. Some is expanding. I mean, there will be winners and losers with climate change, of course.
How so?
Forests are expanding, for example. So some habitats are growing. Like in the north, we see tree line expansion. We see forests moving uphill. So if you're a forest-dwelling species or a tree, actually we're putting on more carbon. In other words, they're growing faster in the northern latitudes because it used to be colder, you know, and now it's warmer. They have a longer growing season. So there are certainly some habitats which are expanding, but there's others which are shrinking. So if you come down here, I'm in Colorado now, and we see forest habitat shrinking because after every fire, it's just too hot and dry at our lower elevations for the forest to recover. So things are on the move, and that means in some areas they're expanding, but that means in some areas they're shrinking.
Now, did I read that there's been no snow yet? Have you had any snow in Denver?
No, we have not. It's by far the latest that has ever happened, and as far as I know, there's none in the forecast for the next week either. It's been exceptionally warm. It's been about 20-25 Fahrenheit above average for the past couple months. And yeah, no, we don't have a winter yet, which is bizarre.
I know we're looking.
You know, this part of the world is pretty variable. So
right, we haven't been skiing in a couple of years with all the shutdown, and my husband loves to ski. That's what I'm thinking. We need to wait maybe till Mardi Gras over here, you know, next February or something. So.
Yeah, you may.
Yeah. When your book, The Atlas of a Changing Climate, you make it so not easy to understand, but it's compelling. Like there's a lot of information. It's not something you can just go through quickly. But I love your writing style, and I saw a couple of your videos that were online, and you make this fun and understandable for the students. I mean, you must love what you do.
Yeah, I do. And I'm glad you say that, because that was the goal. There's a lot of climate change and science books for scientists, but that's not, we don't need more of those, you know, like it's that's not necessarily productive. I like trying to share this stuff with folks that don't have a science education, because not everybody should, you know, not everybody does and not everybody should. There's a lot of other things we need people to do. And so I do hope this is accessible to folks who wouldn't normally think about picking up a science book.
I think it's a beautiful book. I mean, it's a great Christmas gift because the pictures, I don't know how you did all this, but between your old maps and the new lithographs, whatever, you've got so many beautiful photographs. And it's a compelling book.
There are. There are some amazing artists featured in there. And by artists, I mean everybody that contributes the imagery.
Well, Brian Bouma, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana today. Mm-hmm.